Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're back in the Billy Meyer case this evening. Going to review some of the concepts we've talked about before and also maybe cover some things in a slightly different way and maybe cover some new material in the Goblet of Truth. Edward Albert Meyer is a one-armed farmer from Switzerland. He's 77 years old. He lives in a tiny mountain village about an hour east of Zurich. It's called Hinterschmidruti. Billy has had extraterrestrial contacts since about the age of 5 years old. Back in 1945, when he was growing up in Bulach, Switzerland, he got a telepathic message to go out into the Horrigan Forest, and out of the sky came a silvery pear-shaped craft, which landed in a field nearby, and out stepped an extraterrestrial man named Spoth. Spoth was over 1,000 years old, and he was from a race of extraterrestrials that originally allowed themselves to be called the Pleiadians. They are not from our Pleiades. They're from another star system, some 80 light years beyond our Pleiades, a star system that exists in a different space-time configuration. These extraterrestrials are humans. They live in a world called Era. Era is roughly the same size as the Earth, with a very similar gravity and a very similar ecosystem. In fact, in ancient times, they actually brought plants and animals from Earth to Era. Now, the people that live on Era today are highly advanced and are several stages in evolution ahead of the people of Earth. And they have a very profound knowledge of something called the creation. The creation is our universe, but it's a term that also refers to the spiritual intelligence which created our universe. And the people on Era, who call themselves the Pleiaren, live in a perfect balance with nature. They don't mine anything on their planet. They don't extract oil from their planet. They don't extract gas. They don't do horrible things like fracking. They don't use atomic power. They don't even build roads on the surface of their planet. All their manufacturing is done off-world. They keep their populations very, very low. They allow the forests to grow in all their glory, and they follow certain guidelines for living, certain creational natural laws. So they treat the planet with respect and reverence. And Spoth came here to the Earth to be Billy's mentor for the first 11 years of his life. So Spoth led Billy back into a ship and took the craft up some 70,000 meters in the air. And young Billy, a young boy, looking around the ship, he could see consoles with people, images of people. Spoth had been viewing certain people on the Earth, and Billy probably got to see a beautiful perspective of the Earth that very few of us ever get to see. And Spoth told Billy that he would have a very important life, that he would be a teacher, that he would be a prophet, and that he had done this on the Earth in previous lifetimes. And that he had been on the Earth, he had incarnated, his spirit had incarnated as Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. And during this lifetime, he would do a similar thing. He would be a teacher, he would be a prophet, and he would teach an ancient universal teaching called the teaching of the truth, the teaching of the spirit, and the teaching of life. And this teaching teaches the people of the earth about the universal consciousness, the creation, the human spirit, the reincarnation of the human spirit form, teaches us how to control our thoughts and to take personal responsibility. Spoth told Billy to stay in the background, to focus on his writings, that other people would come forward to tell his story. He was told that he would have a hard life, that people would try to kill him, that people would call him a hoaxer, and that even his own wife would leave him and call him a hoaxer. But that eventually, after a very difficult period called the third millennium, the people of the earth would finally respond to this information and a golden age would come in because of this teaching. Sfoth met with Billy for 11 years, and after the final time that Sfoth talked to Billy, Billy was told he would get a second teacher. This second teacher was a woman named Asket, and she was from a parallel universe. You see, our universe, according to the Meyer information, was created in an archetypal Big Bang 46 trillion years ago. And when our universe was created, a parallel second universe was created called the Tao universe. Asket's people are called the Timmers, and they left our universe and moved into the Tao universe thousands of years ago. Both Sfoth's people and Asket's people descend from a race of Titans called the Lyrians. And it says in one of the later contacts that an individual named Nocodamian led his people into the Lyra Vega system, into the Milky Way galaxy, millions, if not billions of years ago. So both the Lyrians, the Plearen, and Asket's people, the Timmers, are related. Anyway, Billy was told to go up on top of a hill and wait, and a robotic craft would pick him up. And he did just that, and out of the sky came this robotic craft. Billy was 16 years old. The craft landed, the door opened. Billy almost felt drawn in. He sat down inside the ship. The ship disappeared. Billy disappeared. He couldn't see the ship. He couldn't see his own body, and the ship whisked away to the Middle East. It landed in a country called Jordan. Billy stepped out. He could see the red rocks of Jordan. He could see the, feel the heat. And then he noticed what looked like a falling star coming out of the sky, which got larger and larger. And then he realized it was a large ship which landed in the sand nearby. And it, nothing happened for a half an hour. And then finally this striking woman stepped out of the ship. And Billy saw Asket for the first time. And he felt that he knew her for some reason. She walked over and introduced herself and said that they were going to go to Egypt and they needed to get in her ship and leave. So they did. Asket's ship landed somewhere near the Great Pyramid of Giza. And both stepped out of her ship. She put a device on Billy's belt, pressed the device, he became invisible. She pressed a similar device on her own belt, and she became invisible. And they went into some secret passage that either Asket could create at will, or one that exists that we don't know about today. But in any case, they traveled far below the Giza Plateau into these old cubical constructions that are some 72,000 years old. And they had to travel down these long, dark passageways. And finally, they got to the headquarters of a group called the Giza Intelligences. And Billy could see the light from this large hallway that seemed to come, the light seemed to come from everywhere and yet nowhere. And he saw this ancient spacecraft. He saw guards. He saw religious artifacts. And he was really impressed and stunned by what he had seen. Didn't know exactly what to make of it all. So Askett and him left and went back to the surface. And Askett explained to Billy that about 11,500 years ago, after the great war between Atlantis and Lemuria, there was a devastating pole shift, and the remaining people of the Earth were struggling to survive. And there came another group of extraterrestrial humans, starting with a man named Eris the 11th, and a whole lineage of these extraterrestrial humans came to power on Earth, and they were called the Giza Intelligences. And the lineage goes something like this. Eris the 11th had a son named Jehovan. Jehovan had a son named Jehave. Jehave had a son named Erisane. Erisane eventually was pushed out of power by a man named Hen, who was also known as Jehovah. And Jehovah was pushed out of power by a man named Kamigal I and another. Eventually, Kamigal I was replaced by Kamigal II. Now, this is the lineage that's described in Contact Report 70. These rulers of this Giza intelligence group. Typically, what would happen is the son would depose the father violently, usually murder the father. Every two or three centuries, this would occur. These people resided far below the Giza Plateau, and they attempted for the longest time to take over the Earth here, and they used religion. And they worked with the people in the Thule Society, they worked with Hitler in Germany, and they had a technology called telenotic impulses. And these telenotic impulses have a way of influencing the people of the Earth. I wonder and I speculate that they may have been involved in the Fatima incident. In Fatima, Portugal in 1917, 70,000 people witnessed something called the miracle of the sun when a spinning disc came out of these clouds and created this tremendous vision that has become known as a religious vision. You see, the Giza intelligences typically used religion to attempt to control the people of the Earth. Anyway, Askett explained this to Billy. This was also Billy's next contact, a woman named Semyase. Explained this in detail in their 70th contact and their 59th contact. So anyway, to continue with a brief summary again of Billy's life history, he continued for 11 years to meet with Askett. He stayed for a while at the Ashoka Ashram in India. He studied various religions. While he was at the ashram in India, the gardeners that worked there would often see Askett's craft high in the air, and eventually they also saw Askett walking and speaking with Billy in the garden there. So Billy eventually met his wife Calliope when he was in the Middle East. He had his terrible bus accident where he lost his left arm. Eventually, him and Calliope went back to Switzerland. They had three children. Billy worked at various jobs for the next 11 years. In 1975, his contacts with Semyase started. She would actually land her beam ship during the day out in the open, step out. And she talked to Billy about various topics, you know, religion on Earth and how that had been a real problem in our development. But she introduced the concept of the creation. And she introduced this material very beautifully. She would say that love and wisdom go together, and that the creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. She also said whenever a human being sees anything beautiful, whether it's a flower or another person or an animal, we should relate that back to the infinite beauty of creation. You see, creation is the superintelligence which created our universe. And 46 trillion years ago, in an archetypal Big Bang, this spiritual intelligence that radiates love and wisdom created our universe, our physical universe, which has been evolving to this day. Our universe is in the first stage of its development. Every universe, and there are billions of universes, goes through these stages of development that are called a great time. And that occurs when a universe expands and then contracts. And then there's a second Big Bang and another Big Bang. Our universe is the initial stage or the earliest possible development of a universe because we have what's called a material belt. And the material belt is where all the stars and the planets and the solar systems and the galaxies reside. More advanced universes do not have a material belt. Now, this is an incredible amount of space. In our galaxy alone, we're talking about 100,000 light years of space. And the scientists estimate 100 to 200 billion galaxies in our universe. There could even be more. So our universe is immense. Creation is immense beyond our wildest imagination. Now, the intelligence that created our universe, according to the Meyer material, is not a religious divinity. In other words, it's not anthropomorphic. It doesn't become angry. It doesn't become jealous. It isn't vengeful. It doesn't get involved in human wars. In fact, they claim it has no personality even. The German word they use to describe the creation is Wesenheiten. And a Wesenheiten is a entity much like air, certain gases, water, are all classified as Wesenheiten. So you can see how the idea of religious divinity or God does not coincide with what the Meyer material defines the creation or the universal consciousness as. However, the universal consciousness does radiate love. And in one of Billy's later writings, he explained it this way. He said, "The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation." And the only reason anything exists is because of the love of creation. And that we should be able to look at a tree and recognize that love is the highest principle in creation and that everything follows that principle in absolute logic. And every tiny plant and every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in creation. And there's a lovely passage in one of Billy's writings called The Goblet of Truth that's entitled What the Truth Knows to Say. And it basically says that rivers, lakes, trees, air, water, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time, which involves many, many lifetimes. And that death is just the passage to rebirth. Rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And that many of these creatures in creation are connected by psychic vibrations. And they're called Wesenheiten. And if you go into the forest and you listen, you will hear the crickets and the cicadas and the birds and the frogs as all of these parts of creation communicate with one another. And you can watch the whole groups of birds as they fly as a unit together, as they land all together in a tree at the same time. All of nature has a connection. And the Meyer material describes it as a tightly woven web of life. And we here, as people existing on the earth at this time, we need to relearn and understand that we are part of this indissoluble web of life, and that we need to stop our destruction of nature. We need to stop our desecration of nature, because we're all connected in a wonderful and amazing way. Now, in the third millennium, the time that we're in now, we're heading for what the Meyer material defines as a third global conflagration. So this has happened before. It's a time of maliciousness that is spreading over the earth, a time of confusion, a time of slowly approaching global collapse, which is also occurring. During this time, our leaders will become megalomaniacal. They will take away our rights of self-determination, and the people, unfortunately, will become indolent and obtuse and indifferent, and this will create a breeding ground for anger and for confusion. And what Billy blames this on, he says, truthfully, none of the duplicitous religions, sects, philosophies, and ideologies are philanthropic in nature. Even though their representatives and believers maintain the opposite, which is a lie, they all talk duplicitously and act accordingly. In truth, they do not know any humane world because humanity is unbearable for them. So they do not tolerate human beings who think and believe otherwise living next to them. If they do, then it is only a pretext. Well, I thought it might be a good time where we could listen to a little music and take a little break here at about halfway point. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Everyone, I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're talking about the Billy Meyer case this evening, as I often do. I want to kind of segue into Contact 150, if I could. But before I do that, I would just like to talk a little bit about the contact reports in general there are over 500 contact reports. Now, I would call the contact reports booklets. They document Billy's contacts with these extraterrestrial humans. The smallest ones are only a page long. The largest ones can be nearly 100 pages, like contact report 150. Now, I was talking briefly about Billy's contacts with Semyase. Yes, the contacts with Semyase started in 1975 in Switzerland. And she met with Billy for 5 years. And she suffered a really horrific head injury and had to break off the contacts. Right around 1980, the contacts picked up with a man named Quetzal, who was the leader of all the stations in the solar system, in our solar system, and also with Ptah, who was the commander of the mothership. Now, we had talked earlier about Quetzal and some of the information that he gave Billy in contact report 150. Let's talk a little bit about, just quickly in an overview of contact report 150. Quetzal told Billy about Saturn's moons, about Pope John Paul II, about the Falkland Islands War, about the crimes of Menachem Begin and Ayatollah Khomeini. He told Billy about the Thule Society in Germany, about the Oort cloud, what existed in our solar system. Quetzal told him about the dangers of space travel and also about the expulsion of the Palestinians. But now Quetzal is going to tell Billy about something called the Destroyer. So let's pick up here where Quetzal is speaking. The original point of origin of the Destroyer is unknown to us, which is why I can only give details on where it found its way into the solar system. Now, by the way, the Destroyer is a comet, a very large comet. Its origin lies in the old Lyrian system where, from time immemorial, the dark planet, called the Wanderer at that time, wreaked system-wide destruction and had brought the earthly moon on the course which led it into the solar system and to that of Earth. Now, what they're talking about is in the Lyra Vega system, in the constellation of Lyra, the original Lyrians had a civilization there. And the Meyer material says it was in a different space-time configuration. And they used to suffer from this comet called the Destroyer, which would come through their system and destroy, sometimes send their whole civilization back thousands of years. Anyway, we'll pick up here with Quetzal. A fact which may appear to many scientists of Earth as unbelievable, fantastic, and as unusual a coincidence, but nevertheless corresponds to the truth. The Earth moon, many millions of years ago, was torn away by the Destroyer as a fragment of a planet 4 million years older than the Earth, and was hurled out into space, heading for the solar system, where it was caught by the Earth as a satellite. Meanwhile, the Destroyer, after the collision with the planet, followed much more slowly the path of the planetary fragment. This is for reasons unknown to us, due to occurrences that we were never able to clarify. In this connection, we can therefore only employ speculations with regard to similar events that are well known to us, but which do not satisfy us regarding the Destroyer comet, and its course into the solar system behind the planetary fragment. So I guess evidently our moon somehow was in front of the destroyer, and that the destroyer was behind the planetary fragment, which is why I would not like to explain our relevant thesis more closely. Although it seems for us, it seems that to be the only possibility of why the destroyer also found its way into the solar system. So it cannot be spoken of as a coincidence anymore. Anyway, that seems very strange to me. The moon, the former planetary fragment, joined itself to the Earth as a satellite some few million years ago, while its successive and much slower destroyer first penetrated in the solar system for the first time approximately 970,000 years ago, whereby it triggered a tremendous Earth catastrophe. So the destroyer was actually traveling slower than our moon. The destroyer is bigger than the Earth, by the way. It's 1.72 times the mass of the Earth. Okay, Quetzal continues here. A large part of the Earth humans at this time, however, found protection and survival because they had been warned by our ancestors regarding the coming of the destroyer and the impending disasters. Consequently, they built structures like the pyramids and other shelters. So maybe part of the reason the pyramids were built was to protect themselves from this destroyer. After the first appearance of the destroyer, it assumed an orbit that regularly carried it every 714 years back into the solar system. It moved through the solar system on its course about 87 times before it altered its orbital path and orbital time in the year 12,943.5 BC. For the first time through circumstances unknown to us. So the orbit switched from 714 years, where it would come back into the solar system, to 575 years. Evidently, this comet is orbiting our sun. It's dropped the moon off to Earth, and now it's orbiting our sun every 575 years. And it creates a disaster every time it comes through. In between there, regularly arose large orbital period variations of years, whereby the lowest orbital period amounted to 412 and the highest orbital period to 670 years. So for a while, there was variation in how long this comet would take to orbit our sun. Quetzal continues, look here, this is the exact data of the destroyer's appearance by year into the solar system, as well as its respective exact orbital period, along with various details which still impart other values for you. Example, disturbances of the Earth by the destroyer and by Venus, which was pulled out of the solar system of Uranus by the destroyer and brought on a course towards the Earth. So, the destroyer comet yanked off a moon of Uranus and deposited it into the position where Venus is now. In other words, Venus was a moon of Uranus. Okay, thus if you begin here, then you have the year 14,812 BC. At that time, which the destroyer still indicated a fixed constant of 714 orbital years. Okay. Quetzal says record this data now and you will have it available anytime you need it. Billy says, how does it look regarding your time if I copy down the data? Quetzal says, don't worry about it. I'll tell you when I must go. Billy, thanks. I'll hurry. He writes down 14,812 BC, 714 orbital years for the destroyer comet. 14,812 1098 BC, 714 orbital years, 13384 BC, 714 orbital years. Now, there are these things that Quetzal refers to as special events. And take note of these. They're very interesting. Special event. The destroyer hurtles on a collision course with Jupiter and disturbs its rotation, whereby it rumbles by so close to the outer layers that an enormous storm develops, rotating and extending into the innermost layers. Question I have, does that mean the destroyer comet created the storm on Jupiter that we still see today? The mass of Jupiter pulls upon the matter of the destroyer and accumulates a particle and moon ring around itself, which persists for millions of years together with the primordial particle and moon ring system, already existent since around 4 million years, into which the new ring will integrate. This is really bizarre. This destroyer comet has a moon ring. Very strange. Okay. The gigantic storm that had already developed in the most primeval times on the colossal planet has nothing to do with the destroyer. Okay. Answered my question there. The concurrent with the passage of the destroyer in the Jupiter system, it pulls a small ancient moon out of its orbit and hurls it with immense speed out into the space of the solar system on an unknown path, accompanied by several smaller asteroids. Okay, let me try to understand that again. It pulls a small ancient moon out of its orbit and hurls it out into the space of the solar system on an unknown path. Okay, I guess a moon is being pulled off of Jupiter at this time. At first, this moon loses itself in a very distant orbital path, where it then reemerges after a long time, moved through the solar system time and time again, until one day it will be recaptured by Jupiter and will crash down into it with great certainty, which, according to our calculations, will be around the time of the turn of the 20th to the 21st century, about AD 2. Okay, evidently this is discussed in Contact 248. But now another question. In the 150th contact report of Saturday, October 10th, 1981, 3:15 a.m., Quetzal spoke of the fact that in 13,384 BC, a small Jovian moon of approximately 4 kilometers in diameter was torn off the destroyer and was taken on a journey with some small asteroids that followed. It was said that one day this small moon will return to its place of origin, even to Jupiter, just to crash down on it. In addition, now the following earthly scientists have made the discovery that presently a small planetoid with a diameter of 4 kilometers approaches on a collision course with Jupiter, accompanied by several asteroids following it. According to scientific calculations, this small planetoid, which is called Shoemaker-Levy 9, should crash down on Jupiter in the middle of 1994. This is an incredible prophecy here. Shoemaker-Levy 9 is a huge event that occurred where those asteroids crashed into Jupiter. Now, the Meyer material predicted this happening in this contact was written in 1981. So Shoemaker-Levy 9, that's incredible. I just have to look this up real quick. Bear with me. Shoemaker-Levy 9. Wikipedia. Okay, let's read a little bit about Shoemaker-Levy 9. Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, formerly designated D/1993F2, was a comet that broke apart and collided with Jupiter in July of 1994. That it said it would crash into Jupiter in the middle of the year 1994, shortly behind the visible horizon of Earth. So, provided the first direct observation of an extraterrestrial collision of solar system objects. So this is the first time we had witnessed an extraterrestrial collision of solar system objects. Goes on to say here, this generated a large amount of coverage in popular media, and this comet was closely observed by astronomers worldwide. The collision provided new information about Jupiter and highlighted its role in reducing space debris in the inner solar system. Anyway, that's straight from Wikipedia. So Wikipedia confirms the Meyer material, I guess. I could make that argument. Okay. Shoemaker Levy 9. That was a big astronomical event that was predicted by the Meyer material on Contact Report 150. Let's go on and see what Quetzal has to say else here. Now, do these small planetoids concern the small moon mentioned by Quetzal, which out from Jupiter on a journey in the year 13,384 BC and now celebrates its return, place of origin, or do these concern another space projectile? Well, now Ptah is speaking. This is strange. When did Ptah join the conversation? They concern the small moon mentioned by Quetzal, which actually arrive again into the gravitational field of Jupiter with certainty, with great certainty. Okay. Another special event. For reason unknown, the destroyer changes its orbital period from this point on is incalculable. Okay. The Meyer material here explains that in 11,503 BC, there was a deluge. Now, the Meyer material talks about multiple floods occurring at multiple different times. So this deluge occurs in 11,500. It's a special event. Maya destruction of the continents of Atlantis following a feudal war with Mu, which we've talked about many times, whereby Mu scientists pulled a small planet out of the asteroid belt and directed it to Earth and into Atlantis, which consequently sank into the ocean and caused a deluge. So that was the deluge of 11,500 years ago. That was because of the war between Atlantis and Lemuria. Then we have a couple more orbits of the destroyer comet. And in the year 10,219 BC, we have another global flood. This is a special event. A large asteroid crashes into the Indian Ocean, causing a deluge. Then we have 575.5 orbital years and another special event. Destroyer rips seven large asteroid belts from the asteroid belt, casting them into various dangerous orbits, in which in coming times, hasn't happened yet, in coming times will endanger the Earth. One of them, get this, one of them probably in the year 2014. Now this, I imagine, is the red meteor. So one of these asteroids could endanger the Earth in 2014. Maybe that's a good place to quit. And next time, we'll maybe talk about this event, which could occur, in fact, this year. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I always enjoy talking about the Meyer material. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder.